the sense of suffering arises, ultimately it's always a wake-up call. It says, look here, this is where you're not awake. It's a very exact science. It's completely foolproof. Now what we do, or how we dance around that proof science can vary a lot. We can wrap a lot of things around that. The mind can have a lot of stories about that, a lot of tangents, a lot of distraction, a whole lot of things can happen around that fundamental essential truth. Wherever there is suffering, that is where you are not awake. Because it's very difficult to abstract suffering, in other words, to not have it be connected to you or the sense of you in some way, as and when it arises, if it arises enough, meaning with enough intensity, or you could say duration in time, it demands attention. In a certain sense, it won't let you go until it gets what it needs to give it a personality, which it really doesn't have. Okay. When the term non-dual is used, it basically means not two, which in translating into what I'm going to try to talk about tonight, it means the absence of fragmentation. So, for example, in insight meditation, one of the classic and very sort of common instructions in the meditation that is given is to learn to pay attention to what's happening without there being any fragmentation, without there being any gaps, without there being any lapses in attentiveness or in mindfulness. And the idea, you know, or the progression there is that if you can pay attention to whatever's happening without interfering with it, without grasping onto it or resisting it, okay, what is happening will show its true nature. In other words, you will awaken into what you already are through that so-called process of paying attention to your direct experience. Now, the tricky thing is that in order to do that in a way where there are no gaps or fragmentation is a very, very precise and subtle thing, where these factors of awakening like concentration, energy, mindfulness, equanimity, need to come into a balance. Otherwise, it's going to be very, very difficult to maintain that kind of connectedness, you could say, with your direct experience. That is why, perhaps, the insight practice evolved in secluded settings, in monasteries, meditation centers, where you didn't have a whole lot of other things going on, where you could really just get in a room by yourself, silent, not distractive, and just really watch what's happening. So that for a half an hour, for an hour, for 2 hours, for maybe a whole period of a day, of 20 hours, for example, or 18 hours, there's this connectedness and pure observation of what's going on. You see, because what's going on, all right, what's going on in every single moment has the potential to liberate you. So what many people find is that what they can actually experience when they're doing intensive meditation in that kind of connected, uninterrupted way, is something that feels, to some extent, quite different than what goes on when they're not in that meditation. In other words, they might get into a space that actually feels transcendent of suffering. For a period of time, nothing disturbs. And then the meditation ends, and life unfolds, and they don't have that, you know, that bubble, you might say, that container anymore. And so anything can kind of happen. And one doesn't feel that one can manage it quite as well. Manage what? Manage what the mind does. It starts reacting. Yeah? It starts resisting. An emotion comes up. In that sort of protected, you might say, secluded environment, an emotion could come up and there may be no reaction at all to the emotion. It just appears and it dissolves. Wow, look at that, it's impermanent. Whereas when one's walking around, going through the daily life experience, that emotion might arise and it gets complicated with other things. It gets, you might say, confused. That just means kind of stuck together with other things. There's the suffering. So in a very simple way, if we, so to speak, could actually not react to anything that's happening, that if whatever was happening was immediately, essentially, and totally accepted and allowed to be as it is, to unfold itself without any interference, that would be liberation. You see? Because there would be no fragmentation, there would be no friction, there would be no drag, there would be no hurt. In the sense that we experience hurt. Now let me distinguish this. Because sometimes the mind gets confused and it begins to project an idea, a fantasy, that freedom is about no pain. Which we need to translate that into freedom is no unpleasant sensations. All that goes away. That's a delusion. That is not true. It doesn't work like that. The nature of this, you could say the nature of the body-mind process, at the feeling level, okay? Whether there's awakenedness or not, whether there's clear seeing or not, whether there's suffering or liberation, the nature of the body-mind process at the feeling level is pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. Those feelings keep unfolding. The difference between the suffering state, so to speak, and freedom is that in the freedom, there's no problem. There's no reaction. There's no trouble with, just we're taking now the example of the feeling experience. In the suffering experience, there's a problem with it. And the fundamental problem with it is that there's an identification with that feeling as my feeling. Doesn't just have that, but around that is, I like it, I don't like it, it's okay, it's not okay. And on we go into what we could call that? Duality, separation, fragmentation. What we actually feel without any kind of deep investigation is that in the moments where we are, quote-unquote, less fragmented, we are happier beings. We are more content, generally. We are more peaceful. We are more at ease. And in that relative absence, and right now we're just talking relative absence of fragmentation, stuff can happen in the world around us to other people that we even care about, deeply perhaps, or an event can occur in one's work or something that is unsatisfactory, and there's less of a big deal, or no big deal about it at all. There's just a response to that. There's just a clear scene of what's happening, and attention to what needs to happen in relation to that. Now, here's the transition. Because it's very difficult to have that kind of seclusion that you can have in intensive meditation, in a monastery, where you can just actually dissect your experience. Or you can, better said, you can watch your experience dissect itself right in front of your eyes with very little interruption. You can stay in a room. You can have a only person that interacts with you is purely there to guide you. They're not there to bug you. They don't say, hey, you're late. You know, you didn't do this right. They just are there to love you and guide you. That's your relationship with another person. Okay, the rest of the time is just in this, you could say, scientific, foolproof possibility of seeing the true nature of things. If it was that easy to see the true nature of things for the masses of us, there probably wouldn't be these secluded environments, there wouldn't be retreats, there wouldn't be monasteries. People would just open into the nature of freedom without any sort of preparation, without any sort of work. Well, guess what? There's a message that's been on the planet for quite a while. There's a teaching, and not just teaching, teachings. There are guided lineages where what I'm speaking about as absolute, simple, ordinary, complete fulfillment in the life that you're living right now is every bit as possible as waking up in a secluded environment without any distraction. Should I talk a little more about this? Yes. Our experience appears constructed to us. It appears constructed to us. How we see our experience is constructed in such a way that actually what we are seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, sensing, feeling, thinking is perceived by our mind as the way things are. How could it not be that if that's what we see, if that's what seems to be happening to us? If there's nothing else that counters that, why should I have any reason to consider that something else is real or true as contrasted to what's actually happening? What we don't so readily see is that the way that we're seeing our experience actually conditions the experience that we see. And so, if experience is going to just happen, however it happens, and we can see this without much investigation, things will just happen the way they happen. You wake up like this, and then this happens, and then that happens, and somewhere in there you might be trying to kind of regulate it, which actually becomes a huge burden if you try to do that too much, because you just feel that you're in a prison that you yourself are making. But you actually let go into how things are happening. And right now I'm talking about in the body-mind process, you let go. These are the best words that I can use right now. You just let go into however it's manifesting. Because if you sit there and, for example, watch the television and you don't take sides with what goes on the television screen, actually what you're doing is watching the television with an unbiased attentiveness. You're just watching it. You're not taking sides.
Okay, every now and then the mind might get into something. Like if you watch the news, it'll take sides on things sometimes. It'll do something. Or the movie, it'll take sides. But other times it won't take sides at all. It'll just sit there in that openness. Well, and sometimes the natural world can be experienced, yeah, through the senses as completely fine. But then you go inside, so to speak, into this body-mind process. You start to look at this. And you find I'm taking sides for or against parts of this experience. Why am I doing this? Why would I do this? Why would I take sides against parts of my experience? Because I don't know what I'm doing. I'm messed up. I'm confused. I'm deluded. I am generating suffering. Once you see this, okay, once you actually see that a portion of the suffering that you experience is self-generated, and you don't have to be in an intensive meditation setting, you know, meditating hour after hour after hour to see this. It will be quite likely that if you sit in that kind of setting, you will see that. Among other things, you will see that so clear. But you don't have to have that environment. So you see that, right? And as you see something, nothing really can transform in this equation of waking up unless it's seen clearly. Delusion has got to go. Ignorance has got to go. Confusion has got to go. In other words, it just simply needs to be seen and seen through. And once it's seen, there's the possibility that you see through it. As you see through something, it's like light going through something. What happens to those particles as the light comes into it? They're transformed. That's how awareness works. But the actual deconstruction of the perceptions that are conditioned in the mind about what is true or real. Because when suffering's hitting the fan hard enough, we believe in its reality, and we believe specifically in the reality that it's happening to us. It's happening to me. I don't like it. And something needs to change. Even if I just escape a little bit into the mind and start mantraizing, this too will change, this too will change, I hope soon, maybe in the next few minutes, just relax, Paul, take it easy, don't take it so personal, blah, 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 blah. I'm actually attempting to have a shift. Okay. What I'm going to begin to point at here is the possibility that when there is no need anymore, for an instant even, to not run, to not attempt to escape suffering. Okay? Not because you're a masochist, not because you're stupid, but because you're waking up. That hidden in that which hurts is the medicine of cure. Hidden in that suffering is the dualistic perception that creates the fragmentation that I am here, the world is there, I am separate, and to that separation I add the longing, sometimes deep longing, to come home. But if I'm confused, if I'm deluded, if the mind is reacting and struggling with suffering, I will be assured that I don't know where home is. I want it, but I have no idea where it is.
when the teaching, and Buddha didn't apparently say this, it came out after him, because some very interesting things historically came out after the Buddha was around. Right? What evolved in the non-dual traditions of Tibetan Buddhism. Amazing things came out historically. 13th century, 14th century, 12th century, sometime after the Buddha had come and gone. Amazing teachings came out that were not necessarily articulating this awakening possibility in the same way that the original school of the elders, the Theravada Buddhist school, articulated things. Because it's very important to understand that if you really see the Buddha's teachings clearly, you see that those teachings deconstruct themselves. They start from a position that sounds like there's a dualistic world, there's a you, and then there's other things, and there's a progression towards unification or release from anguish, suffering, unhappiness. What happens is that teaching that seems dualistic and progressive eventually, in all the lineages, deconstructs itself. What they do in the Zen tradition and in certain schools of Tibetan Buddhism, they deconstruct it right up front. They deconstruct it so much that they say, there is no progression, there is no place to go, there is nothing to get. You are already enlightened, but you don't see that, and therefore there seems to be a process of waking up to what you already are. What you see in more the schools of Theravada Buddhism and certain aspects of Hinduism and certainly in Christianity, the Judeo-Christian tradition, is that there's this notion of evolving towards that which you are. You are not that yet. In fact, you're far from that. You're a sinner. You've fallen from grace. And here's what you need to do to fix it. And a prescription, a list, is given. In the core direct non-dual paths, there's no list. There's not even a meditation. Ultimately, there's nothing at all. Which can easily lead people sometimes to thinking that, and therefore trying to believe that everything is fine, and they're simply lying. They don't have that direct experience. They're just in denial. It's a total spiritual bypass. So, once it's clear that there is this tendency to identify with particular aspects of experience as who you are more than other aspects. For example, the person simply and by habit identifies with the happiness that they feel as who they are more than the fear that they feel. There's duality. Awareness doesn't identify. Awareness simply sees. However, we add to awareness the idea that we're aware. Isn't that interesting? Where did that come from? Did it just pop out of the invisible? Did it come out of the nothing like everything else? Well, I mean, what is that about? Why do I do that? What you begin to see is that tendency to say, I am this, not that. I am that, not this, is actually the nature of suffering. Straight up, right down the middle of this, is the possibility that you don't have to say you're anything, nor do you not have to say you're anything. You don't have to claim anything or not open to anything. Because even without contemplating ourselves deeply in any way whatsoever, just kind of basic common sense, it becomes radiantly clear to anyone who opens their eyes, metaphorically and literally, this is completely, utterly, all of it unpossessible. I can say this is my stick, but it's really just a figure of speech which I add on to with and then experience the result of that. If we could simply take ourselves out of the binds that seem to just appear, or that we ourselves create, I'm making a distinction, by recognizing the truth of consequence, or the law of karma, a lot more people would not be suffering like they are. I'm not saying that the law of karma, cause and effect, isn't a very important teaching. I'm even suggesting that the tendency to identify with awareness as what you are could be a karmic process. But who can track that down? Show me the point in history where you first started to identify with awareness as what you are. That's the point of separation. And it's very difficult for most human beings to remember through will, or even through just relaxing, you know, going into a meditation, what it was like to be here in the state of non-dual, non-separation. But it happened. Every one of these bodies sitting here was living as just one expression in the non-dual, unbounded field of awareness prior to the point of identification with awareness as what I am. So, the very thing that seems to be the most difficult aspect of being here, and I'm naming that as suffering, has the awakened nature of things as they are, all things as they are, hidden in it. And yet around, as I said, just to start the talk tonight, around that suffering and that potential that liberation exists within it, is all of the dances and permutations and tangents and tributaries off the river that human beings engage in. And isn't it fascinating, the varieties of ways that we actually, to put it one way, could be distracting ourselves from that potential to wake up. Not to judge it, not to say, you know, there's right or wrong or better or worse ways to distract yourself. But what a radical thing to consider. What a, in a way, upsetting to the conditioned mind consideration. That in the very thing that seems to be most difficult about being here is the freedom that you, in your quiet, clear, reflective, meditative mind might be interested in discovering. How does it happen, though? How does that shift happen? Because it's going to be, it must be, it is a fundamental shift in the perception of what is real or true. Either suffering is real and will continue at its own will until it doesn't, or suffering is an appearance, like a dream that you have at night, that you say for sure is not real when you wake in the morning. That wasn't real. This is. Actually, we don't know what is real. We don't know what is true until we've really seen what suffering is. When we're confusing it with unpleasant feeling that we don't like, yeah, sure, that's part of it. when we're confusing it and isolating it to things happening that we don't want. Things that we like, that we'd like to have continue, not continuing. People that we want to stay in association with, leave us. People that we'd rather not have in association, find their way to us. And we simply eat a food like, for me, there's a certain kind of soy milk that the tongue loves. It just likes it. And every time that particular kind of soy milk goes into this body, it creates irritation in the stomach. Without exception. Now that's kind of stupid to keep drinking it, wouldn't you say? So the mind figures out a way to sort of try to have this without too much of this. So it cuts down the amount. And it cuts down the amount, and it cuts down the amount, and it cuts down, it goes right down to like a few ounces. It still gets the irritation. Then it goes into now what? Now what? Attempting to control or manage. Have what it wants, not have what it doesn't want. This is a game, and until this game is seen through, there's no way. We're going to see the light of illumination inside that which appears to be the most difficult thing about being in this world. Check it out right now. Is there a more difficult thing about being in this world as a human being than suffering? And you can play that out in any number of ways. How that suffering appears to you. What you call suffering. What doesn't feel okay to you. What we sometimes think is that if there is no more identification, right? If there's no more possession of things, that everything's just going to fall apart. Now I have to possess things, you know, I have to take control, I have to be responsible and do this and do that, otherwise shit's going to hit the fan or it's going to get worse. It's already hitting the fan and it's going to get worse. It's going to just be chaos. Keep your hands on the wheel. Try to hold it lightly now. Don't hold it too tight. Hold it lightly, but stay in control. What we don't see is that attempt to stay in control is a complete fallacy from the get-go. There is no such thing as control. There's the thing called sort of managing things, but you're not controlling things. It's a delusion. Because if you could control things, then why don't I just go around and control life in such a way that there's no more suffering? Nothing doing. So we can conceptually appreciate that letting go of identification and not holding things as ours makes sense. That it opens life, that it brings fluidity, that it brings more ease, that it brings more peace and comfort, relatively. But we still can find, if we look inside, we can find ourselves holding on to a sense of ourself without actually even knowing clearly what that self is. Often it's connected with the body-mind process. It's connected with this form. The more identified with this form, clung or attached to this form I am, the more fear I will have about what can happen to this thing. Knowing all along, if I don't even meditate, just it's right there in children that this dies. You don't have to see death, you don't have to read about it in the comic book, see it on the television. It's children know this is impermanent. It's just almost there. Like the blood flows in the vessels. It's just obvious. But to identify with this as what I am, to cling to this as my possession, is in full-on contradiction to the fact that this falls apart, that this ceases to be animated. So then what some people do is they say, okay, well, let me just live the best that I can, have as much fun as I can, enjoy, try not to hurt others, you know, to get some good values going, and go through the 60, 70, 80 years. Try to have a good time, enjoy the sensory world, maybe even get into some contemplation, get deeper, get quieter, get more still, realize there's a happiness beyond my sense pleasures, and that's a life. Maybe then you take the sense of the outer creativity that people engage in. Like, I was thinking about this last night, watching Obama's speech about going into the Afghanistan again and talking to the cadets at the West Point. And they're all there in their uniforms, and they're young. They're very young. Young women, young men. Some of them are going soon. Some of them are going to die. And he's standing up there knowing this. So he's starting a speech, you might have seen it, but he's starting a speech, and he's just, you know, the words are like, he's nailing it. I mean, he's memorized this, I guess, and it's a 37 or 36 minute speech, and he's nailing it. And it feels good, to me at least. And at a certain point he starts talking about himself as the commander-in-chief, which he is. He says it several times, and you can start to feel his energy just, he gets kind of like stronger, like if you're going to hit that pool ball harder, he's now going to that spot, and he's starting to say some things that he's energizing himself behind. Stronger. He's almost getting taller. Willpower, conviction, belief in cause, heart energy, passion, life and death. This is important. All these things could be going on. Is he identified with the result of his actions? Or is he just trying to do the best he can and just open the space for life to work? Don't know. I'm not in there. I can't read his mind. It said that the Buddha had to be so convicted to go beyond what he had been conditioned to believe was true that he had to basically leave. This is just one story. He had to leave everybody else, go off by himself, leave his teachers because they said, this is it, man, you can't go any further than this. He said, no, there's still suffering here. There's still delusion here. And he goes off and he does his own thing. What did he find? We'll never really know for sure because none of us were there, and what he actually found is indescribable anyways, but take a shot at it. He found that if it's possible to observe certain things and not interfere with them, that maybe it's possible to observe everything and not interfere with it. When you can observe everything and not interfere with it, and as I said earlier, where's the trouble? What might be left is, the trouble is, you are still identified as the one who's watching. And if you're identified with the one that's watching, then that watching is separate from that which is being watched. When the identification with the watching falls away, the watching and that which is being watched. The end of separation. Whatever allows us the possibility to actually deconstruct our tendency to identify with things and through identifying with things, attempt to a little or a lot possess that thing. That's the way out of suffering. What happens in the insight practice, as I have experienced it, is that that deconstruction or disidentification happens through just observing the flow of phenomena. And observing it closely and carefully enough. And it was maddening in my case to be instructed in how to do this and then try to do what I was being instructed to do. It was like it felt absolutely insane to face the mind at that level of sensitivity and closeness. And yet, being a good doobie, I did what I was told. Gave it my best shot. We can't fake this stuff. We can't think our way to an answer. We can't think our way out of identifying with things as what we are or what we're not. We can't think our way out of being possessive, grasping human beings. We have to experientially see how the process works, how suffering actually happens. And as it's seen how it actually happens, it deconstructs itself. Let me stop here.